leading scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captain of a scientific, technological elite.
We've signed a climate convention on the importance of economic instruments and free markets. We're included in this mammoth Agenda 21 document and the Rio Declaration. Now, let me be clear on one fundamental point. The United States fully intends to be the world's preeminent leader in protecting the global environment.
Coming up, Technocracy News. And greetings from Technocracy News and Trends. Patrick Wood here. Today is February 3rd, 2020. We're going to talk about two primary topics today. One is going to be the coronavirus that's happening in China right now and around the world. We'll cover that second. And first, we're going to talk about green spending and what's going on in the House of Representatives and around the country on green spending, so to speak. That is the Green New Deal. This is a very disturbing thing that's going on right now, and we need to pay attention to it for certain. I have said for over 40 years that the progression of the original New International Economic Order proposed by the Trilateral Commission back in 1973 has never been about party politics whatsoever. It's not a conservative or a liberal or a Democrat or Republican issue. It is completely transcended national politics. However, these people will use national politics to get their own agenda accomplished, and they have for well over 40 years. This ought to tell us something about today's scenario where we have all kinds of conflict going on in political parties. But meanwhile, behind the scenes, the new international economic order is just marching forward as if nothing is wrong. It reminds me of a movie I remember from years and years ago called Run Silent, Run Deep. It was a World War II flick about a submarine. And of course, submarines do run silent and run deep, especially when the enemy's trying to attack them. They go into stealth mode. Well, this is the way that all of this new economic system has been coming at us for all these years. It's been a submarine under the water that can just travel at their own will without any concern about what's happening on the surface. Battles, gunships, doesn't matter. So we see this continuing today. And even as President Trump has sworn that he's going to get us out of the Paris Climate Agreement, and to some extent he has, the policy of our own government now has been 100% in line with the Paris Climate Agreement. In other words, we're saying on one side, we're going to get out of it. On the other side, we say, hey, we're going to do it, and we are doing it. The first article I want to talk about today is titled House Sneaks Green New Deal Spending and the Infrastructure Framework. Now, this is really boring, I'm sure, because infrastructure, economics, oh no, we go to sleep with that kind of stuff. Well, listen, I wrote at the top of this, the carrot on a string is fixing the things that everyone knows desperately needs fixing. And isn't that the truth? And all around America, things seem to be breaking down at alarming speed. But the real payload now in this new spending bill is zero carbon, environmental justice, green transportation, and alternative energy. How's that for a mix? This is the press release that I just pulled off of house.gov. There's a link in the article to it. You can go read the original press release. It was dated January 29, just a few days ago. The press release states, now this is not a journalist writing about the press release. This is the actual press release. It states, today, the chairs of three U.S. House committees released a framework for a five-year $760 billion investment in infrastructure that would address some of the country's most urgent infrastructure needs, from addressing the massive maintenance backlog to designing safer streets to putting the U.S. on a path towards zero emissions. Bingo. They talk about massive maintenance backlog. Sure, we have one. Lots of things need to be fixed. Do we need safer streets? I suppose to some extent, but what happens in a city is none of their business. That's the city's business to make safer streets, but it gets right down to the nut of it when it says to putting the U.S. on a towards zero emissions. This is exactly what the Paris Climate Agreement was all about. Bringing the world to a point of zero emissions, getting rid of all fossil fuels whatsoever, anything that creates CO2 that goes into the atmosphere. You know what they never told you, and what probably never occurred to you, certainly not to most people, is that humans also emit carbon dioxide. They are emitters, quote unquote. And if you truly want to have zero emissions, what do you have to do? You get rid of the fossil fuels, get rid of all the animals that produce flatulence that have methane. They've declared that to be evil too. But even if you could possibly get rid of all those things, you would never, ever get to zero emissions because humanity breathes out carbon dioxide. So even if you got rid of everything else, you're still not down to zero. You'd have to get rid of all the people as well. And some of the people in environmental movement really do want to get rid of people. This press release continues. The framework put forth by Transportation and Infrastructure Committee Chair Peter DeFazio, Democrat from Oregon, Energy and Commerce Committee Chair Frank Pallone, Democrat from New Jersey, and Ways and Means Committee Chair Richard Neal, Democrat, Massachusetts, would bolster the federal role in order to help communities around the country undertake transformative projects that are smarter, safer, and made to last. Among other things, the framework outlines major investments, including those in transit systems, airports, ports and harbors, wastewater and drinking water infrastructure, brownfields, and broadband. Broadband, by the way, is 5G. It's infrastructure investment that is smarter, safer, and made to last. And the press release gives several bullet points, which I need to go through. Bullet point, brings existing infrastructure into a state of good repair and enables the completion of critical projects through long-term sustainable funding. Sustainable funding? Well, we'll see what that is. Point, sets a path towards zero carbon pollution from the transportation sector, creating jobs, protecting our natural resources, promoting environmental justice, and increasing resiliency to climate change. Promoting environmental justice? Increasing resiliency to climate change? I thought President Trump said that climate change is a scam. Not true. That's why he's pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Next point. Ensures a transportation system that is green, affordable, reliable, efficient, and provides access to jobs. A green transportation system? If you haven't figured out what this means yet, it means get all the cars off the road, get all of the gas-guzzling and the diesel-guzzling engines out of any cars that remain, and let everything be electric, which we already know is not really any cheaper than any other type of energy that's produced, but it's much easier to control it. Next point, provides safe, clean, and affordable water and wastewater services. Next point, prioritizes the safety of the traveling public. Next point, this will get you, helps combat climate change by creating good-paying jobs in clean energy, investing in energy efficiency, and reducing greenhouse gas pollution. Well, this has sustainable development in the United Nations written all over it. It's absolutely amazing. And I'm not going to read the rest of this to you except for one more sentence down below. I want to remind you again, this is the actual press release that was posted on the website, house.gov. You can go there and read it yourself. It's amazing that in light of all of the citizenry around our country that has said we want out of this nonsense, the House of Representatives is moving ahead full speed with creating a sustainable green future that nobody really wants. One other sentence I'm going to read from Chairman Pallone, who said, "There is no better way to strengthen our economy for the future than to modernize our badly aging infrastructure," to which we can say amen. We need to modernize our badly aging infrastructure. Then he goes on and says, quote, "This bold framework not only helps us rebuild our nation, it also combats climate change by reducing carbon emissions and moving us toward a clean energy future. It's just too much to handle. But then in the next story, which is also very recent, the title to this story is Democrats Push National Climate Bank to Further Green New Deal Spending. A national climate bank. I wrote at the top of this article, a national climate bank would aggregate $1 trillion to invest into transformative green infrastructure and clean energy projects. This promotes pure sustainable development, aka technocracy, but paid for by taxpayers. The bill is sponsored by Representative Debbie Dingell, Democrat from Michigan, who was formerly a very active Republican in her early days, until she met and married the late Representative John Dingell, also a Democrat from Michigan, in 1981. And by the way, Representative John Dingell passed last year. This article states, the idea of a national climate bank is catching on in Congress, and it could infuse billions of dollars into efforts to eliminate the U.S.'s planet heating carbon emissions. A handful of congressional proposals have been made over the past year calling for the government to start investing in technology upgrades and inventions that would cut down on greenhouse gases. Funds from the National Climate Bank would ideally lower the financial risk associated with green innovation, encouraging private investors to throw more money into the pot without shifting costs to consumers. The hope is that the bank can tackle everything from building up the infrastructure for electric vehicles and solar power storage to making communities more resilient to the effects of climate change. A national climate bank is at the center of a broad set of policies proposed this month by the House Committee on Energy and Commerce. The effort, called the Climate Leadership and Environmental Action for Our Nation's Future Act, the acronym for that is CLEAN, by the way, if you spell it out, you'll see it, is aimed at bringing greenhouse gas emissions down to essentially zero by 2050. The National Climate Bank would pull together the public and private investment needed to transition to an economy with pretty much no carbon footprint, except, of course, for the people still left on planet Earth breathing out that evil, evil carbon dioxide. It builds on bills introduced in both the House and Senate that would create an independent nonprofit bank capitalized with $35 billion in federal funds. That bank could mobilize up to $1 trillion in total public and private investment over three decades, advocates estimate. So we'll see at the bottom of this in the end is public-private partnerships, by the way. The private companies will bring money to the table to bond with public money and public resources and assets to create a clean future for us. It continues, it's a business-friendly environmental strategy with bipartisan appeal and a proven track record thanks to the success of state and local green banks, advocates of the national bank say. I think this should be one of the less controversial provisions that people talk about because I don't care who you are. We need to be investing in innovation and technology, Congressman Debbie Dingell tells The Verge. Dingell introduced the National Climate Act bill in the House in December. Senator Ed Markey introduced a similar bill in the Senate in July. The bank they're proposing would be able to fund projects directly and funnel cash into existing regional green banks. Now, I have to add in passing, as most Technocracy News readers will already know, that Senator Ed Markey, Democrat from New York, is teamed up in a very, very close relationship with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the House. And he has endorsed every aspect of AOC's Green New Deal to completely remake America into some other image than what we have today. And this is indeed a future that most Americans don't want. But the House, which allocates funds, our taxpayer funds, to all of these crazy projects, is working overtime to spend trillions in the end on creating a green future that's going to bring about nothing more than scientific dictatorship and technocracy in America. This is amazing. Only Americans and only citizens that vote can make a difference on these people in Congress. That's one good reason that we have to continue to educate and alert people as to why they need to vote these people out of office. But let me be clear. There are just as many Republicans that are doing things on the other side of this issue that are just as disturbing as this. They also need to be voted out of the mix and replaced with people who truly will put America first and not United Nations programs like climate change, Green New Deal, or other things that would be totally disruptive to the economic system that made America great in the first place. The second topic I want to cover today has to do with the Wuhan coronavirus. This is definitely an important topic. I'm not interested in any conspiracy theories, by the way, on how it happened, who did it, who leaked it, or whatever. But there are other issues that need to be discussed here. The first article I posted that's relevant to this is called Globalization Faces Disaster with Supply Chain Leaving China. This article is originally penned by Charles Hughes Smith, an excellent economic analyst. I wrote at the top of this, the finely tuned global supply chain built by corporate technocrats is being disrupted by the black swan event of the deadly Wuhan virus in China. The shock of economic standstill, lack of travel, missed deadlines, etc., could provide a Lehman moment. You'll remember Lehman Brothers back in the financial crisis in 2006, 7, and 8, and the subsequent domino effect. So Smith writes, everyone expecting a quick resolution to the epidemic and a rapid return to pre-epidemic conditions would be well served by looking beyond first-order effects. While the media naturally focuses on the immediate effects of the coronavirus epidemic, the possible second-order effects receive little attention. First order, every action has a consequence. Second order, every consequence has its own consequence. So the media's focus is the first-order consequences, the number of infected people and fatalities, government responses such as quarantines, and so on. The general expectation is that these first-order consequences will dissipate shortly, and life will return to its pre-epidemic status with virtually no significant changes. Second-order effects caution, not so fast. Second-order consequences may play out for months or even years, even if the epidemic ends as quickly as the consensus expects. The underappreciated dynamic here is the tipping point, the imprecise point at which a decision to make fundamental decisions tips from maybe to yes. These tipping points are often influenced by exhaustion or frustration. Take a small business that's been hit with tax increases, additional fees, more regulatory compliance requirements, etc. When the next fee increase arrives, the onlooker might declare that the sum is relatively modest and the business owner can afford to pay it. But the onlooker is only considering first-order effects, the size of the fee, and the owner's ability to pay it. To the surprise of the onlooker, focusing only on first-order effects, the second-order effect is the owner closes the business and moves away. Invisible to everyone, focusing solely on first-order effects, the owner's sense of powerlessness and weakening resolve to continue despite soaring costs and declining profits has slowly been moving up to a tipping point. Beneath the surface, every new fee, every tax increase, and every new regulation has pushed the owner closer to, I've had it, I'm out. When the owner shuts the business, onlookers can't understand how one little extra fee could trigger such a fundamental change. The observer is only looking at the new fee as a single cause and a single consequence. In the real world, each new fee, tax increase, and regulation was another link in a causal chain of consequences generating consequences. Turning to the possible second-order effects of the epidemic in China, let's start with the decision to keep supply chains in China. The reasons to keep supply chains in China have been dwindling for years. Wages and other costs have been rising. The central government has increased demands for technology sharing. The general sense that foreigners and foreign companies are no longer needed or wanted. And the trade war, which is more or less in a truce phase, rather than over. One common belief is that it's impossible to move supply chains out of China. This is a classic first-order effect analysis. When the supply chain gets disrupted for one reason or another, and alternatives must be found, alternatives are found. What becomes impossible isn't moving the supply chain from China, but keeping it in China. The mistake made by those only considering first-order effects is that a modest effect should only generate modest consequences. For the observer focused solely on first-order effects, if the coronavirus epidemic blows over as expected, then supply chains should, quote-unquote, be unaffected because the effect is quantitatively modest. But once we start considering cumulative second-order effects and potential tipping points, then the disruption of supply chains caused by the epidemic, no matter how modest, could be the last straw to those who had beneath the surface already shifted from never leave China to maybe leave China. The epidemic could tip the decision process into must leave China. Well, these are excellent thoughts, and I would recommend that you read the full story that was written by Charles Hugh Smith and continue with this analogy to see what he sees down the road potentially for the impact of companies in China and those that may well just throw in the towel and say, I'm out of here. Can't take it anymore. It's gotten too much. Then on Saturday, I decided to write my own article called Coronavirus, an Analysis in Relation to Technocracy. And for readers of Technocracy News, obviously, this is the issue. How will it play out in relation to technocracy? I wrote in this article, people around the world are in near panic over the potential pandemic emanating from the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak in Wuhan, China. Face masks and bottles of hand sanitizer have been flying off shelves, and trips involving air travel are plummeting. Not surprisingly, there is a mountain of disinformation with attendant conspiracy theories racing around the internet, all of which only exacerbate the fear and muddle the facts that we know for certain. Subtitle, Zero Hedge banned from Twitter. The widely read Zero Hedge news site was completely banned by Twitter over the weekend for quote-unquote violating community policies. The ban was apparently due to the release of a certain scientist's email and phone number, both of which are publicly and freely available elsewhere. The scientist in question, Dr. Peng Zhao, is a prominent researcher at the Wuhan University of Virology and happens to lead the bat virus infection and immunization group. Coincidentally, his lab is only 20 miles away from the epicenter of the outbreak in Wuhan. The frenzied questions concerning motive of the outbreak are largely pointless at this time. It happened. It is what it is. Real answers might surface someday, but not because governments anywhere are known for their honesty and intellectual integrity, especially China, the United States, and Canada, all of which, by the way, are wrapped up in one way or another in some conspiracy theories floating around. In light of this, I would direct readers of Technocracy News and Trends to think about the role played by technocracy and its technocrat operators. Subtitle, China is a technocracy. China is a full-blown technocracy that has elevated science and engineering to godlike status. They are noted for their mastery of technology promoting scientific dictatorship, where every citizen is tracked, monitored, and socially engineered to the satisfaction of the controllers. Furthermore, their economic system is completely engineered by technocrats. I have repeatedly noted and warned of the carelessness of technocrats in the object of their studies. Data security in smart cities is always an afterthought. Massive computer systems are routinely hacked, exposing personal data of hundreds of millions of people at a time. Amazon's Ring cameras are increasingly hacked to terrorize unsuspecting children and their parents. Boeing 737 MAX airplane was grounded because of amateurish software developers who failed to adequately test their creations. You get the idea. When technocrat engineers build complex laboratories able to handle the world's worst killing agents, like Ebola, SARS, anthrax, and even the Spanish flu, which, yes, it has been captured, grown up in laboratories, and it's being studied, there could be no room for error. When these labs are staffed with human scientists who decide to experiment with genetic engineering to see what they can come up with, there can't be any room for error. The obvious problem with this is that errors always creep in because error-prone technocrats simply don't think things through to the very end, and they end up creating things they cannot understand. In my opinion, this new coronavirus outbreak bleakly underscores the built-in structural failures of technocracy in general and technocrat achievements in particular. In deference to the original father of technocracy, French philosopher Henri de Saint-Simon, 1760 to 1825, science is not a god, and there is no priesthood of scientists and engineers. Subtitle: The Global Supply Chain is at Risk. China itself has absolutely no reason to purposely release a killer virus that would choke its economy and besmirch its already tenuous scientific reputation. The gigantic and precision-oriented global supply chain that it helped to create, including all of China's Belt and Road initiatives, is at risk of serious disruption, if not complete collapse. It would be truly insane for China to intentionally jeopardize 45 years of progress. However, no one can rule out the possibility of an act of eco-terror by a group or even a single person. There are plenty of death-crazed zealots in the world who would count it a great victory and even a pleasure to kill thousands and terrorize billions more. The global elitist who created the economic paradigm of sustainable development through the United Nations have been preparing for an economic reset, that is, death, of capitalism and free enterprise. In 2015, the head of climate change at the UN, Christiana Figueres, clearly stated this, quote, "This is the first time in the history of mankind that we're setting ourselves the task of intentionally, within a defined period of time, to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution." Since then, governments and central banks and UN-linked NGOs have all jumped on the sustainable development bandwagon. Anyone who has read my latest book, Technocracy: The Hard Road to World Order, knows that sustainable development is functionally equivalent to technocracy, which was originally created in the 20s and 30s. No matter what happens from this point forward, the economic impact of the Wuhan coronavirus will be an order of magnitude greater than the health impact. This implies at least temporary shortages of products that are dependent on the global supply chain to work correctly. Unfortunately, that is most products that are necessary for modern living. Further, the already fragile global financial system could seize up, resulting in another financial meltdown. In the meantime, expect bizarre social behavior that will further exacerbate the situation. For certain, we should keep our eye on the coronavirus story coming out of China and watching it around the world as it spreads to other countries. The contagion has not been nearly as great outside of China, but that could change rapidly at any time. And within China itself, hundreds of thousands appear to be affected at this point. Many have died, and likely more will die as time goes on. However, for those people who have had the virus and survived, there will be an immunity that's built up that will prevent them from ever getting it again. And for all the people who have developed a prejudice against China for this outbreak, the social outcome will continue. Racism is raising its ugly head, where Chinese of all stripes around the world are being blamed or being shunned. This, of course, is no better than any other type of racism. It's not a good thing at all, but it's happening. Well, it's food for thought. I'm Patrick Wood for Technocracy News and Trends. See you next time.